Okay, folks, welcome, and welcome aboard, I should say, to the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky. As I speak, I'm the Porkmeister, of course, and Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, is just down the line. I have to ask you your first question of this podcast. Ms. Jones, are you enjoying your bank holiday?
What's a bank holiday? They kind of
holiday.
Don't exist anymore, do they? I mean, I remember bank holidays being a big deal when I was a kid.
Yeah.
My father preferred not to go places because the roads were always hell.
Yeah.
And of course, this weekend, the roads were hell. I tried to go on a 52-mile journey. I set off. After an hour and a half, I was no further down the road than 2 miles. And I turned around and came back because where are all these people going? They can't all be going to shopping centres and garden centres, can they?
Well, I don't know, but I totally agree with you. A bank holiday in our house used to mean staring out of the window, you know, in Chester, just on the border with North Wales, to see whether it was going to rain or it was going to be sunny. And then you had to take the big gamble whether we all piled into my dad's Morris Minor estate and went down the coast road to what you would call God's own country, Prestatyn or Rhyl or Llandudno, for a day out on the beach. Wonderful days, but it was only good if the sun was out. If the sun wasn't out, sitting in the back of a Morris Minor estate, eating jam butties and drinking pop all day while the rain bounces off the roof is not to be recommended.
Well, neither is sitting in a car. I mean, surely all these people can't be that happy about sitting in their car for hours on end to get somewhere to have, what, fish and chips out of newspaper or whatever kind of paper they do these days, and then turn around and come back. It must be absolute hell. When I was married, my former husband refused to go anywhere at all on a bank holiday.
Yeah,
especially on a bank holiday Monday.
I know people who like that, yeah.
Yeah, why sit in the car? But I remember when I was a child, there was a thing where I think all the men in working class families went on a coach down to Margate or Ramsgate or somewhere, and they'd all get absolutely lashed in a pub and then all sing their way on the coach back home. And that was a day out. But that was during a time when people did very little else. So that was a treat. Nowadays, I would describe that as torture.
Yeah,
actually, that's not a treat at all, is it?
I totally agree. I've said before on this podcast, I quite like bank holidays when the world is back to normal because it does calm things down for a bit. We all work at frantic pace. We all have demands on us every working day. And so I don't mind a bank holiday, to be honest, just to calm things down. Now, Ms. Jones, you, like me, really are the national newspapers every day, and you'll have been aware that the Daily Mail is now publishing historic copies of their newspaper, but because they're celebrating 125 years of publication. And of course, we have to have a Beatles story in every podcast, and one's given to us on a plate here. They've reproduced the paper from February the 8th, 1964, with the headline, "We Love You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah." And it's the Beatles landing at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York for the first time. It was so long ago, the airport wasn't even called JFK, John F. Kennedy. But it's the first landing of the Beatles, and millions, well, certainly tens of thousands of people, mostly young girls, are at the airport, and they had no idea of the reception they were going to receive.
It was astonishing, wasn't it? That was when they were going to America to do the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
That sort of groundbreaking time in their career. I don't think millions converged on the airport because I don't think the airport would have fitted millions, but certainly thousands of fans turned up.
Yes.
And they weren't prepared for it.
No. Do you know what? I remember reading somewhere else, not in this copy today, but Ringo actually looked out of the window when the plane had come to a stop on the tarmac and saw all these people and said to the other members of the Beatles, he said, "I think the president or somebody must be arriving. There's thousands of people out here all shouting." And they had no idea that we're going to receive this incredible reception, which then overtook them. So that's the Beatles landing. But let me tell you, this is so nostalgic for me. The date is February 8, 1964. And the headline writer, not the headline writer, the story writer is Geoffrey Blythe. It says from Geoffrey Blythe. Now, that was 1964. When I first got to America 20 years later, in 1984, Geoffrey Blythe was still a regular in Costello, still propping up the bar, you know, telling stories of having been to Vietnam and all that. But he never told me his Beatles story.
I never met him, unfortunately. He was way before my time.
He was, but, yeah. Yeah,
those incredible writers who just they stuck around for years, didn't they? Well, decades.
Listen, if you turn inside to this historic edition, the next two pages, 2 and 3, are both written by a man called Vincent Mulcrone. Now, of course, that name will be huge to you because you spent a great part of your Fleet Street career drinking in the Vincent Mulcrone bar in the Harrow, didn't you?
That name means nothing to me at all. I do remember the Harrow.
No, that upstairs bar at the Harrow is now called the Vincent Mulcrone Bar.
Is the Harrow still there?
Yeah, it's still there. The last time I was there, I went in there and I spoke to the guy, you know, behind the bar, and I said, I used to know Vincent Mulcrone. And the famous story is, it's where they used to have what's called morning prayers, okay? All the great Fleet Street legends, you know, like Vincent Mulcrone, a couple of guys from The Express, whose names I can't even remember now, would all pitch up at the Harrow at 10:30. It didn't open to anybody else until 11:30. And there were two glasses on the bar waiting for them. One was a glass of tap water, which was to clean out the system from the excesses of last night. And the second one was the day's first glass of champagne. And that was the start of a day's work. They all did most of their work in the pub all day long. But
I remember going into the Harrow quite a lot because I had my initiation in the Harrow. But I always thought it was a bit of a sleazy little place in a sort of back street, on the corner of Tudor Street, more or less.
Right. But they all were, weren't they? All the Fleet Street bars were that in those days. But
what was funny was that each of the pubs had their own specific pub and you weren't supposed to go into one that belonged to another newspaper.
You weren't, because you might pick up secrets and stories and all that kind of stuff. You're absolutely right. But anyway, there we are. Did you ever meet Harvey Goldsmith?
Lots of times. Yeah, I knew Harvey pretty well.
I was going to say, I bet you did. And I saw a picture of him and he's auctioning a guitar, but it's a very, very special guitar. It's been signed by almost every great rock star of the generation. You know what I mean? Bowie and Keith Richards and everybody else. And I thought, well, you know, good for you. He's auctioning it for charity. But that'd be quite something to own, wouldn't it?
Well, it's not just a guitar. And this is an astonishing thing. He has mounted an exhibition. It's going to be on May the 5th. So that's Wednesday. That's this week.
Right.
At Bonham's. And it's his whole memorabilia collection, not just this single Les Paul gold top, which was signed at Bob Dylan's 30th anniversary concert.
Right.
And it's signed actually by George Harrison, Eric Clapton, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Chrissy Hynde, Tom Petty, Neil Young and Stevie Wonder. And they reckon they're going to get 10 to 15 grand from that. But there are also signed posters. There's a handwritten letter from Bruce Springsteen, which they reckon will fetch between £3,000 and £5,000.
Yeah.
There's a signed portrait from David Bowie at £2,000 to £3,000.
Yes.
I mean, Harvey is the legendary promoter. He promoted the Freddie Mercury tribute concert, the concert for Campuchia at Hammersmith Odeon, and of course Live Aid, which he masterminded with Bob Geldof, at the Pheasantry on the King's Road, which is now a branch of Pizza Express.
Oh, really?
And they arranged and masterminded the entire concert from there with a paper map of the world and a pair of old wooden calipers, with which they managed to work out where the single satellite in the world at that time would be over which countries, so that they could tune into the broadcasters, the national broadcasters of each country as the day wore on. It's an extraordinary story. I mean, what I always want to know in situations like this is why? Why is somebody like Harvey Goldsmith, who is wealthy beyond compare, who has amassed this very valuable, beautiful collection of rock memorabilia, why is he selling it?
Well, that's a very good question. But in the last couple of years, we've seen people like Elton John sell a load of furniture, haven't we? And, you know, they have almost like garage sales and they sell, you know, like stage costumes and all that kind of stuff. Now, I've got a theory on this. I'm nowhere near dying, hopefully, okay? However, anybody who doesn't make plans for what comes next is a fool, because you know as well as I do that if you don't draw up a will and get your affairs in order, it can cause your relatives an awful lot of aggravation. You know, if things aren't put into place because you go intestate, which means that lawyers have to spend years working out, you know, who deserves what of your wealth and all that kind of stuff. So I do understand that. But the other thing that kind of bothers me, right, and I'm not being maudlin about this, I do not expect to die anytime soon, but I've got a very big collection of sports memorabilia. You know, I've got Wayne Rooney's first England shirt. I've got Wayne Rooney's first boots that he wore for Everton, signed by Wayne Rooney. I've got a pair of John, what's his name, the captain of Chelsea's boots. He's now at Villa. Sorry, his name's gone right out of my head, of course. England defender.
John Terry.
John Terry, thank you very much indeed. Must be getting senile.
And you or me?
No, me. And, you know, I've got mementos from the old Wembley Stadium. You know, it's knocked down. It's my favourite football ground in the world, and new Wembley Stadium and all that. Now, I think to myself, supposing you die of a heart attack, because it can happen, obviously, you know, and it's instant, all that kind of stuff. What then would the people who come and, you know, clear my property make of my memorabilia collection? And what would they do with it? And would it just get thrown out? And remember, we saw a piece recently from a great female Fleet Street journalist who said she had to go round to her mum's house after her mum and dad had both died. And she was just dumbstruck at what to do with her possessions. So, you know, I think there is a case to say you may as well offload them, because when you die, they're going to cause a problem.
Well, would your nieces and nephews not cherish those things because they belong to you?
I doubt it. And that's not because they're callous or unkind. I've got a very close relationship with them and with my sisters, you know. But why would they want to take what they probably consider a load of junk into their house? Funny enough, when my mum died, we had exactly the same problem. We went to the house, thought, oh dear, what are we going to do? And years ago, my mum was a big John Wayne fan, okay? She liked John Wayne films. So years and years and years ago, I bought her for Christmas, as well as a proper present, I bought her a little present with snow in a John Wayne bubble. Do you see what I mean? You know, you turn it upside down. You
a
put
snow
it
globe, back. You mean?
What, sorry?
A snow globe.
A snow globe, okay, yeah. That's right, yeah. And that remained on her you know, her windowsill for, like, you know, 30 years, I think, something like that. And when Mum went, sadly, you know, 2-3 years ago, God rest her soul, that now is in the bedroom that I stay at my sister's place in Bournemouth and I go down there. Do you see what I mean? But it was the only thing we rescued, because we just didn't know what to do with the rest and it just had to go.
I've got a lot of stuff that belonged to grandparents and great-grandparents. And my daughter said to me, my eldest said recently, you need to make a list of all of those things and who they belong to, you know, what's the origin of them and stuff. Obviously, she's not going to keep it all. I'm a bit of a hoarder of things like that. I love family memorabilia.
Sure.
But you're right, it's not going to be kept. Most of it is going to be offloaded.
Yeah.
I suppose what you could do is bequeath certain things to charities, or you could bequeath them to the football clubs, or, you know, make sure that they have some sort of life after your death.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've thought several times, actually. We've talked about those hotels in Liverpool, haven't we? The Dixie Dean and the Bill Shankly. I've thought...
Well, they're closed down now. The guy's gone bust, tragically, because of the pandemic and their guests.
You don't think they'll reopen again?
No, I don't.
Oh, what a terrible shame. Because I thought that I've got a letter from Dixie Dean and to my grandfather. I never met my grandfather. He died before I was born. But it was retained by my father, and I've now got it. And I was going to give that to the hotel and say, look, put that in a glass case on the wall, please, and just put a little note under it saying, you know, courtesy on loan from Mike Parry or something like that. You know what I mean?
Most of these big football clubs, they've got museums.
Yes, they have,
on their premises.
Yeah, no,
so
they
I
have.
Think it's a good thing to bequeath. We had an interesting one in the family a couple of weeks ago. Wolverhampton Wanderers had made a posthumous award to my great uncle Bryn, who played for them before he was sold to Arsenal for the world record transfer fee in 1939. Oh. And there was a medal awarded posthumously.
Yeah.
And because obviously my uncle Bryn is dead, his daughter Margaret, my cousin, very sadly died last year. Mm-hmm. And they weren't aware of the fact that there was a brother, an older brother actually, who's my cousin Brinny. He's one of these people who keeps himself to himself, hasn't had much to do with the family over the years, and nobody knew where to find him. Mm. So, of course, the family came to me and said, You were the journalist. You track him down. Yeah. Well, it wasn't that hard. You know, it's not that hard to find somebody. Yeah. Of course, I found him. I called him up. We had a long chat and was able to put him in touch with the football club. And they made the award to my cousin Brinny on his father's behalf, which I thought was rather wonderful.
No, I do. I think it's rather wonderful at all. Talking about keeping things, would you have any interest in keeping Al Pacino's three-piece pinstripe suit from the movie Scarface, which has just sold at auction for £60,000? Why would somebody buy that? I just don't get these people who go around buying the clothes of dead people. You know, when I saw that people were bidding hundreds of thousands for a Diana Princess of Wales dress, I thought, God, how macabre is that?
Well, you're not going to wear it, are you? And it must be a bit threadbare by now, because that film was made in 83, I think it came out.
Yeah.
You could have it altered, I suppose, if you wanted to wear it, but why would you walk around in someone else's old bit of garb? Do you remember that film as well? Did you go and see it?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
What a terrible film. I mean, I walked out at the point when they were sawing the legs off some guy in a bath. And yeah. I just thought, no, this is just evil.
Yeah.
And I left. I can't watch anything like that.
Yeah.
He played, didn't he? He played a Cuban refugee who became a drug lord. And it was a very sinister film.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to own anything to do with that film.
No, I totally agree. On the other hand, Al Pacino, 81 last week, by the way, is such an iconic American Italian actor, isn't he? I mean, you know, the actor of his generation, I suppose.
Scarface, very much so,
yeah. Yeah, Scarface was one. And I agree with you, by the way, that horrifying scene where they chained people to the shower rail and then brought in a chainsaw and all you saw was blood spurting out of the bathroom.
It was horrendous.
I totally agree. But Al Pacino, of course, made his name and was famous for the Godfather films, wasn't he?
Yeah, I suppose it's a little bit typecasting, isn't it? I mean, you know, Italian American. Yeah. Oh yeah, so he has to be mafia. He has to be in the mob.
Oh yeah, but he carried it off so well. I mean, Godfather 2, yeah. In my view, is one of the greatest acting roles ever. You know, Michael Corleone, fantastic.
The film I loved of his was Scent of a Woman, where he played the blind retired general.
Right.
And do you remember he drove that sports
drove
car
a Ferrari.
Through the streets of New York completely blind and managed to fool a police officer.
Mm. Yeah, I loved all Al Pacino's films. You know, he made another one where he was a sort of washed up old financial dealer trying to con people into buying insurance policies. I can't remember what it's called now. But anyway, everything he's ever done, I've liked. Tell me, Miss Jones, how old were you when you passed your driving test?
17.
Yeah, right. And me, although I failed my first one, but I took it a second time when I was still 17. But I read this piece here. Today's car-free teenagers are missing out on vital lessons. This is a feature piece from a lady who's just found out that teenagers have lost interest in driving, in getting their, you know, their driving license and feeling that freedom you get the minute you can climb into a car and disappear. I simply can't believe that. We told a story, or you told me a story a couple of weeks ago about how you once borrowed your dad's Capri at the age of about 19 or something. I mean, that was the thrill in those days of being allowed to drive your dad's car or your mum's car, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I remember I put my mum's car into a wall the first time I drove it.
No.
She wasn't very pleased and she didn't lend it to me again after that.
Yeah.
I do get this. I think, okay, I lived in the country. I grew up in Kent.
Yeah.
And you couldn't go anywhere unless you could drive or unless your mum and dad would drive or your mum or your dad would drive you somewhere and pick you up at the end of whatever, the dance in the church hall or whatever it was.
Yes.
So you sort of had to learn to drive. I think living in London, my three kids have all grown up in London. You don't need a car in town. The transport links, when they work, are very good.
Yes.
And now, of course, we have Uber. I think that's been a big influence
definitely.
On kids wanting to learn to drive. Because if you drive, obviously, you go to a pub, you can't have a drink.
Yeah.
You've got to be the designated driver.
Sure.
Uber is very cheap. So most kids can afford to get an Uber home. They can get there on the bus or the train, wherever it is, and they can get themselves home by Uber, especially if three or four of them share. You know, that's a couple of quid each, isn't it?
Sure.
So I think the incentive to own a car, coupled with the fact of eco disasters, climate change. Yeah. They're all very conscious of what we've done to the planet.
I agree.
By owning and driving so many cars.
I agree.
And so the emphasis isn't on having a car anymore. Yeah. Also, it's very, very expensive.
It is very expensive. I totally agree. And if you live anywhere near a major city these days, it's no good having a car because the authorities have squashed the roads so tiny that it's a frustration to drive. There's bus lanes, cycle lanes, all sorts of restrictions, extra congestion charges for all sorts of things. It is a nightmare. But in my day, I worked tirelessly for 18 months working in a garage at weekends, as well as being a reporter during the week on the Chester Chronicle, just to gather enough money to buy my own car, because my old fellow was so mean at lending me his car, he always thought I was going to crash it, you know. So all my other mates at school always, you know, turned up in their dad's cars, and I had a constant battle trying to get my old fellow to do it. So I thought there's only one way to do this. So I saved up £325 and I bought a G Reg Vauxhall Viva turquoise. I have never felt so good in all my life as the moment I drove that car home, parked it in front of my house, and then went round and picked up my girlfriend. I was the only guy who had his own car. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful feeling. I loved it. We went on holiday to Cornwall in it, you know, and everything. And it was just a great feeling. But you had to work hard to keep a car in those days because of things like insurance and tax and all that. But I don't understand anybody who doesn't want a car. I mean, you're absolutely right. All the time I lived in New York and Washington, D.C., I didn't have a car because you didn't need one. Where were you going to go? You know, where were you going to park it apart from anything else?
Well, London is like that now, and I'm sure other cities are too. And ever since Dear Sadiq introduced the 7-day-a-week congestion charge,
yes,
you know, which
is
ludicrous. We used to be able to drive in at weekends, a bit of shopping on a Saturday, bit of lunch, a bit of church on Sundays. You know, now you have to pay £15 to go to your church. And people say, well, find a more local church, but it's not about that.
Of course it's
not. A church is not a building, it's a community, and all your friends are there, and so on. So you don't just want to stop going to the church you've always been connected to.
No.
So that's not an argument. I'm a bit cross with Sadiq for all kinds of things.
So am I. I think he's destroyed London. I read a piece about him yesterday, you probably did, by David Mellor. And, I mean, he's got huge debts, £300 million or verging on sort of £3 billion, you know, in bailout loans he's going to need from the government and all this kind of stuff. What I don't understand is, right, there's a place I use in town called The Ring. It's near Southwark Tube Station. You may or may not know it. And it's right opposite Transport for London HQ, which is a massive building of about 12 stories and goes back about, you know, two blocks. And I think to myself, that building never used to exist when we didn't have a mayor. And we didn't used to have a mayor in London because we didn't need one, because it ran itself. And it's just been an invention of local government people to employ hundreds, if not millions, of people in jobs that aren't needed to be done. And it's all taxed to us, the ratepayer.
I agree. I had a little leaflet through my door yesterday from Sandy Toksvig, the comedian. And this is on behalf of the Women's Equality Party. Now, this actually makes a lot of sense. And she's talking about the fact that 60% of COVID job losses are expected to fall on women.
Terrible.
And that half of London's nurseries are facing closure. And, of course, the soaring rates of violence against women and young girls. So the Equality Party, you know, we get two votes, don't we, this week? And she's suggesting that the Women's Equality Party, that we all share one vote on the orange ballot so that we can get the first Women's Equality Party representative elected in the London Assembly, because they don't have one yet.
Right.
And they missed out at the last elections. They missed out by 1.5%.
Yeah.
So, you know, to get them with a representative to change all those things aforementioned, but also to bring a bit of sense into proceedings. Mm-hmm. You do need balance. You do need male and female in every situation.
Yeah.
So I think this is a really good suggestion.
Yeah.
So I reckon if everyone who listens to our podcast gave one of their votes to the Women's Equality Party, I'm doing a bit of a campaign here, I think that would be a very good move indeed.
Okay. Well, you know, you have my full support there, Miss Jones. Whatever you say should go. The other thing that's bugging me in these local elections is what's going to happen to Scotland. But that's too boring a story for us to talk about on Life on Planet Porky. I mean, too boring. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick, the writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, it's about time I gave you a rendition on this podcast. Those were the days, my friends, I thought they'd never end. I'd sing and dance and the rest of it. You know, I forget the lyrics after the first one and a half lines.
Yeah, but you forget them after the first word, I think.
Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely true.
The variation on a theme is very entertaining,
variation
Michael.
On a theme. And that's because Mary Hopkin, actually, there's no S on the end, is 71 this week, okay? The singer from the Swansea Valley, hello boyo, signed to the Beatles record label at 18 after being recommended by model Twiggy, who'd seen her on Opportunity Knocks. What was the name of that guy did Opportunity Knocks? Huey somebody. Turned out
Huey
to be
Green. Huey Green. He turned out to be Paula Yates's dad, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, exactly. After being asked to call the company, So Twiggy rings up Mary Hopkins, said, oh, I saw you on Opportunity Knocks. You sounded quite good to me. Look, I think you might have an opportunity in the music business, and gave her a number to ring. So after being asked to call the company, Mary Hopkins rang this number and a bloke answered the phone with a Liverpool accent. So she explained who she was and he said, OK, well, why don't you come down to London and we'll have a chat about it. And she didn't know till she got to London she'd been talking to Paul McCartney. And of course, you know, in those days, in like 68 or whatever it was, he was one of the most famous men in the world. But I thought she was lovely, Mary Hopkins, a sweet young Welsh girl who kind of, you know, lit up the airwaves.
Absolutely lovely. And she had such a pure bell-like voice, didn't she?
Yeah.
She ended up marrying Tony Visconti.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah.
David Bowie's producer.
Oh, yeah, right, and, of course, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, she sings backing vocals on a few Bowie tracks as well.
Yeah.
But such a lovely voice. I never understood why her career didn't last longer.
Well, I don't think she applied herself to it. I don't mean she was lazy or idle. I just don't think she was a career singer. I think she was a folk singer who, you know, picked up by Apple. They were looking for new artists. Nobody ever quite knows who wrote that song. Those were the days. I thought it was.
Oh, well, it's an old folk song. No. It's a traditional song that dates back, you know, centuries, and they adapted it.
Yes, that's what I mean. Lennon McCartney just sort of arranged it for her, didn't they?
Yeah. That's quite common, you know, that the sort of origins of songs. Date so far back, nobody knows where they came from.
But, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She certainly made it into hers. I mean, everybody knows who she is because of that song, don't they?
Yeah, no.
Didn't she represent us at Eurovision once?
Yes, she did. Yeah, and was it Knock Knock, Who's There?
That was
Would
the
it
song.
Be love that's calling.
Come that was
in,
a crap
the door
song,
is
though,
always
wasn't it?
Open wide. Actually, I remember the words of this. And, knock Knock, Who's There? Take off
you
your
remember
coat.
The words, right?
yeah. Take off your coat and come inside. But I
it's a rubbish song. I'm not surprised it didn't win.
Well, that's right. But the poignant line in Those Were the Days was "Once upon a time, a lonely tavern," and it's a recall.
No, once upon a time, there was a tavern.
There was a tavern, that's right, yeah. But it's a recall back to youth, isn't it? Because then it goes on. Was that lonely person really me? Those were the... And I hate songs that are like almost, what is the word I'm looking for? Wailing and moaning about lost youth. You know, my...
A dirge.
A dirge, that's right, yeah. My motto in life is that you can't live for yesterday, you can't live for tomorrow, you've actually got to live for today. Do you agree with that?
Well,
you seem stunned by that,
sorry, I was just having a gulp of tea.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. Don't let me get in the way of you having a breakfast, will you? No, thank you.
Mm? No, I think that I agree. Sometimes music is unbearable to listen to.
Yeah.
And certainly when I've gone through tragic moments in my life, I do switch off. I can't listen to anything that reminds me of why I'm so sad.
Yeah.
It just seems to exacerbate my state of mind. Yeah. And it becomes unbearable, so, just as it is unbearable sometimes to look at certain photographs or read certain letters, that kind of thing.
Yes,
anything
I agree.
That takes you back.
I agree.
And you have to revisit the source of that pain.
I agree.
But, you do move on. Obviously, music is my life. I live my life to music. And there was a time when I couldn't even listen to my children playing the piano. because it just seems so poignant. And I was so grief-stricken at a particular time in my life.
Grief-stricken about what?
Marriage breaking up, that kind of stuff. Dear. But you do get over these things. Yeah. You do have to pull yourself together. And I think the answer, Jackie Collins said this to me years ago, whenever things were unbearable, she would get in her car and she would play the loudest rock music. She had a stack of tapes in her car and she would just drive and drive around on the west coast of America and she would just play the loudest rock music to bring herself back to the present.
Yeah,
and I agree with you that the present is the only moment we should concern ourselves with.
Absolutely. You know, you can have hopes for the future, great, but don't live on hopes because they probably won't come true. You can have regrets about the past, but you're just going to kill yourself. You know, we're all going to kill ourselves. Like, oh, if only I'd done that. If only I'd done that, you know. For instance, I reckon now that what I should have done when I was a young reporter on the Chester Chronicle is I should have advertised in the New Musical Express for gifted young musicians who need a lyricist, because I was great at writing poems, okay? And I thought I could have. And, you know, I've looked back occasionally and thought, you know what? I could have been Bernie Taupin, you know, Elton John's lyricist. I could have been Tim Rice, you know, the great lyricist who worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber, if only I'd decided to have a go at it. But I was too busy making a career in Fleet Street. I might, Miss Jones, I might chuck a few people. I might still go into that business even now.
Well, why not, if you think you have what it takes? Yeah. I know a guy called Ray Williams, and he famously in the music industry, although nobody knows who he is outside of it, introduced Reg Dwight to Bernie Taupin and effectively created Elton John.
Yes, of course he did. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
But it doesn't, you know, he didn't make a fortune out of it, got to say.
No.
So really, you need to be a bigger slice of it rather than just be the guy who introduced this one to that one.
Yeah.
You need to be the guy that comes up with the words. So
why
not have a go? As far as we know, you only live once. Mm. So if you think you have what it takes, give it a go, Mike.
Yeah, I totally agree. The only problem is that I think you could have cashed in big when I was thinking about this in the 70s, but people don't buy records anymore. And what you get on a download is, I mean, nothing compared to what you used to get when an album got sold, is it?
Well, the thing is that nowadays you can buy tracks. You don't have to buy the whole album.
Yeah.
So you can just go online and you can pick and choose the tracks that you like and put them on your playlist. You don't have to buy the entire album anymore and, you know, just pull it off your shelf and play the one or two tracks that you like and forget the rest.
Yeah.
So the way we consume music has changed so dramatically. Mm. But certainly the concept album has gone out the window, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't know why people bother to pay for downloads anyway. If I want to listen to a bit of music at night, I put on YouTube and watch all those brilliant, you know, videos that go with the music. But that's just me.
Well, yeah, but if you think about it, you are doing a great disservice to musicians by doing that because you're not paying for it.
No, I agree. I totally agree.
Nobody is getting paid when you listen to music on YouTube.
Yeah, I know, but how can I pay for it? If I want to watch the video, I've got to watch it on a TV screen or a laptop or a computer. You know, it's not like if you download onto your phone and you just want to listen to it on the train coming home. I want to see it as well. You see what I mean? And I don't know where you can pay for that.
Well, I do understand, but I think you should probably buy the track as
I agree. Do the decent thing. I have, of course, written a song in the last 12 months, Ms. Jones, which you will be aware of. It's called Ode to the English Pub, since the pubs have been closed. And in fact, I will give you a rendition of the first verse now, as we're 2 weeks away now from the pubs reopening. And it goes like this. Oh, to be in an English pub in spring, with frothing ales and tasty beers and all the joys it brings. Ooh, right now it's sadness and it's sorrow, booba, booba, booba. But soon they'll open the doors, we'll be back in tomorrow. How about that?
Well, you heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to get a record deal and absolutely no question. Somebody listening to this is going to be straight on the phone after we finish.
I hope
so. And they are going to be offering you a mega multi-million pound deal.
That would be great. Any volunteers, please get in touch with me immediately. That was only the first verse. There are four verses all together and each gets better as we go through it. Now, that's a bit of a fun and a bit of a laugh. But I want to tell you about a very serious subject, Miss Jones, and that's about the number of scams which people can fall prey to on their phones these days, okay, or any form. But anyway, you and I were talking about a story about some chap who handed over £8,500 for a tractor he was buying, but it was an eBay scam. The money disappeared. The tractor never appeared. And you read so many stories like that now. But let me tell you one that I want to point out to you and all our millions of listeners. I kept getting a message from a company claiming to be DHL. And DHL are one of the most famous delivery companies in the world. We know them worldwide. And they used the DHL logo. And it said, your parcel is awaiting delivery. Please check on your tracking. Now, I suspected this was a scam because I wasn't expecting a parcel, okay? So I didn't open that. It came as a, what did it come as? It came on Twitter. No, it didn't. I'm sorry. It came as a text to my phone. That's right. It came as a text to my phone. So I thought, how could they have got my number and why? Anyway, I didn't open it. I deleted it. It came three or four times over the next 3 or 4 days, and I kept deleting it. Now, the reason I did that is because I'm aware of somebody who works in the property business who got a similar one from another reputable delivery company. I can't remember which one, with the logo. He opened it and it completely stole over 20,000 files from his electronic network because the phone was connected to his computer. And it was a blackmail demand to pay £2,000 for them to restore it.
There are a lot of these. I've had a number from DHL, also another delivery company called DPD.
It was DPD, the other one. You're absolutely right, DPD.
I don't order very much online. Yeah. Because, I've never successfully ordered an item of clothing, a garment, that has fitted me properly. Sure. And I hate shopping, but every now and again, you've got to go shopping and you've got to go and get something because you need something for something.
Yeah.
But I hate doing it online. I don't order very many things. I always keep a note of something I've ordered. And if you get a message like this out of the blue and you know you haven't ordered something, it's fairly obvious that it's a scam and you just delete it.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of people do fall for these things. There are also the ones that come around saying that you've been chosen in some ballot, you've won a ton of money, and you have to go into this. And all you have to do is open the email or whatever it is, and they've got you.
Yes.
So be aware. I just say to the kids all the time, be aware.
I do as well.
Don't open dodgy emails that look genuine. Yeah. What I usually say to my mum as well is look at the top at the email address.
Yeah.
Because there was one going around a couple of weeks ago, TV licenses. You haven't renewed your television license, you owe money.
Yeah.
Well, if you do it on a standing order, you don't need to renew it.
Of course.
So that's a scam for a start. But I said to her, look at the email address at the top of the email, and it's always gobbledygook. It's always something that looks non-official.
I totally agree.
So that's how you tell that it's not real.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But it is a problem, because as you quite rightly say, older people will be fooled into it. The guy I'm talking about, right, in this business, he refused to pay the ransom. And he runs a very efficient business. And most of all, the most important documents had been run off by his staff and put into paper folders in filing cabinets. Very old-fashioned, but it saved him from going bust virtually.
Yeah, well, just people need to be more aware.
Yeah.
And here's another one that my mother had recently. Somebody called her purporting to be her bank manager.
Oh, golly, that's deadly.
And she thought, well, that's strange. She thought, that's odd, because I've been and had a meeting with the bank manager just recently, so why would he be calling?
Yeah.
And she said, I came in to see you last week. And he said, no, this is about something else. Could you just give me your, the second and fourth of your PIN and then the first and the third and all this? And, of course, she'd seen that thing on television, that little advert, where if you're asked for the second and the fourth and then the first and the third, they've got the whole number, haven't
they? That's right, of course,
So they can compromise your account very easily.
Absolutely.
But she asked him to call back, and then she called us, the kids, to say, what do I do here?
Yeah.
Mom, it's obviously a scam, well, he's going to call back, which he did. These people are so brazen.
Oh, yeah.
And she actually said to him, I know you're not my bank manager. And the guy kept on. She said he was so convincing, but by this time she was well aware of the fact that he wasn't her bank manager.
Yeah.
But the fact that he kept calling, and she's an old lady, she's 86 years old.
Utterly disgraceful, isn't it?
What sort of person? Lives on her own.
What sort of a person does that? Hey?
But how do they find somebody like my mother? That's the thing that bothers me.
I think they just cold call. I get calls all the time. I've still got a landline, although only about two people in the world ever call me on it, you know, family, because I don't want it to be used. Because, you know, the thing about having a mobile phone is you walk around with it and you can either answer it or not answer it. But you don't want a phone ringing in the house all the time, do you?
No, exactly.
So I hardly ever use it. But nevertheless, I get calls from India all the time. You can tell it's a long distance call and just put it straight down again. There is a scam about where if the phone rings, I mean, I've got a screen on mine, so I can see the number coming up, okay? And if it's one of these weird numbers that I don't recognize, you just have to let it ring out. The minute you answer it, something happens, something triggers, or you get a bill or something like that. Anyway, look, enough about scams. Let's talk about things which are rather more efficient and rather more trustworthy than those scams. Do you know the name of the man, Michael Collins, Leslie Ann? Does that mean anything to you?
He was on the moon expedition, Apollo 11.
Absolutely.
He died recently?
He did. Well done. He has. And he's the age of 90. He's died. But, I mean, he's got to be a hero of the world. And I say that because you're absolutely right. He was on the moon mission, but he was the world's most forgotten man because he stayed in the capsule that kept orbiting around the moon whilst Collins and Buzz Aldrin were on the moon's surface, you know, walking around. By the way,
Collins and Buzz Aldrin. It was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
I beg your pardon, of course. I'm going mad. It was Michael Collins in the
for the second
capsule.
Time this podcast.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Not for the last time, probably. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the Earth's surface. I didn't realise, by the way, they were only on the moon's surface for 21 hours because the whole world was so captivated and I was only a kid, but my memory is they were there for about 3 days, you know what I mean? But they were only there.
You know
for-
what I always wonder as well? Where did they have a pee?
Well, that was all built into the spacesuit because they didn't eat any solid food, you see. It was all like sucking stuff through straws and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but even when they were on the moon's surface and they weren't wired up to their whatever they were wired up to.
It was all built into the spacesuit.
Right. And they must have stank when they got back.
Well, you know, I don't think we have to go into that sort of detail, Miss Jones. You know, it's for the sake of mankind, after all. You know what I mean? But
a giant leap.
But for periods of time lasting about 20 minutes, Michael Collins was completely cut off from every civilized person in the universe because his capsule went behind the moon towards the, you know, went round the dark side of the moon, as Pink Floyd would have known about. And he was completely cut off from any communication with anybody anywhere in the universe. And that must have been a terribly frightening thing, going behind the dark.
I don't think Pink Floyd went there, of course, but no. They wrote about it. That must have been absolutely terrifying.
Absolutely.
I've often wondered, how do these guys not go crazy?
Yeah,
you know, it suddenly occurs to you, you're how many miles up into the, you know, beyond the stratosphere, and do you turn around, do you panic, how do they hang on to their sanity in situations like that?
God knows. I mean, that's why they're such special men. Buzz Aldrin, you know, stepping out into space, connected only by a cable. Otherwise, you float off into oblivion and you die inside your spacesuit of starvation or something, you know, about 3 weeks later. The most horrific death you can imagine. But Buzz Aldrin was such a brilliant mind and so physically perfect that when he stepped out into space from the space capsule, his blood pressure went down, not up. It was the only time in history that was recorded. A man got calmer going into space than you know, getting more kind of stressed. Amazing man, really. And also, he took a picture of everybody and every living creature known to God or man, except for himself, because he took a picture of the Earth as he was going around the moon. So I had a picture of the moon with Buzz Aldrin and Armstrong on it, and a picture of the Earth in the background. So every known living creature in the Milky Way was in that picture except him. But anyway, look, I digress. A very, very...
Every known living creature,
yes,
was in the picture.
Well, there were, because he took a picture of the whole of the Earth. So everybody on the Earth was in the picture, and he took a picture of the moon And everybody on the moon was in the picture. And as far as we know, there were only two people on the moon, unless the Martians were hiding, unless the moon men were hiding. Martians, they come from Mars, actually, don't they?
What are you on this morning? You're talking a load of gibberish. I mean, come on. That picture, the pictures that he took of the Earth, you can't see any living creature on the Earth because it's too far away.
No, you can see the Earth, and the Earth contains
the
only...
Yeah, but you can't see creatures on it.
No, but we know that the only creatures in the whole of the universe, which stretches about 8 trillion light years in every direction, are on that planet Earth, the blue planet. I'm telling you, I know what I'm talking
about. You know they're there, but you can't see them. I'm not following your argument here at all.
Well, I'm sorry, Miss Jones, but you need to apply yourself more.
What you're saying is he didn't do a selfie, but I suppose we hadn't thought of selfies back then, had we?
You could take a selfie. I don't think you'd point your camera at yourself was the vote. Now, Miss Jones, when we all get out and about again, it's coming soon, you know, soon the pubs will be open again. I've got bad news for you. You might wait an hour for your food. Crisis for restaurateurs who can't get the staff. Restaurants are facing a recruitment crisis with a shortage of chefs, kitchen staff and waiters, which are going to scupper reopening plans because of two things. One, a lot of people have gone back to Europe after Brexit. And secondly, they've drifted off and found other jobs which pay more than being a waitress or a waiter on the minimum wage. Do you think we're going to have a problem?
Well, there's also a massive shortage of jobs because businesses all shutting down due to the COVID pandemic. So it should even out,
I
would say.
I totally
Anyone
agree
who hasn't
with you.
Got a job knows where to go and get one.
I totally agree with you. But every bar I've been into since, you know, the Gardens reopened, and I think in total that's only about 4 or 5, but I've been in some of them more than once, but not regularly. They've all got signs up. Seriously, they've all got blackboards up. You know, vacancies, you know, staff wanted, you know, weekend help needed, all that kind of stuff. So, but you're absolutely right. There is going to be a gap for employment, and there should be people who've, you know, sadly suffered in other areas of the economy who can get back in there. Right. Okay, folks. Well, that's it. Ms. Jones, thank you very much indeed for joining me again. As I say, only a week or so to go until the pubs reopen, a great landmark for me. Ms. Jones, take care to all other millions of listeners.
Put your teeth back in and have another drink.
Well, I haven't had a drink yet, actually. I don't know what kind of reputation you think
Why are you slurring, then?
No.
You've been up all night, haven't you?
No, admit it. No, I haven't. I watched Line of Duty last night, by the way. And got that one out of the way, and a bit of a disappointment, I have to say, in the end. But there we are. Right,
Moving swiftly on.
Say again.
Moving swiftly on.
Okay, folks. So until the next Planet Porky, please take care. Have a good what's left of the bank holiday week ahead. And Miss Jones, again to yourself, look after yourself, and back with you very soon. My motto in life is that you can't live for yesterday, you can't live for tomorrow, you've actually got to live for today. Do you agree with that?
Well,
you seem stunned by that,
sorry,
Ms. Jones.
I was just having a gulp of tea.
Oh, right, okay, don't let me get in the way of you having your breakfast, will you? No, thank you. So I had a picture of the moon with Buzz Aldrin and Armstrong on it. And a picture of the Earth in the background. So every known living creature in the Milky Way was in that picture except him. But anyway, look, I digress. A very, very...
Every known living creature was in the picture?
Well, there were, because he took a picture of the whole of the Earth. So everybody on the Earth was in the picture. And he took a picture of the moon, and everybody on the moon was in the picture. And as far as we know, there were only two people on the moon, unless the Martians were hiding, unless the moon men were hiding. Martians, they come from Mars, actually, don't they?
What are you on this morning? You're talking a load of gibberish. I mean, come on. That picture, the pictures that he took of the Earth, you can't see any living creature on the Earth because it's too far away.
No, you can see the Earth, and the Earth contains...
Yeah, but you
only...
can't see creatures on it.
No, but we know that the only creatures in the whole of the universe, which stretches about 8 trillion light years in every direction, are on that planet Earth, the blue planet. I'm telling you, I know what I'm talking
about. They're there, but you can't see them. I'm not following your argument here at all.
Well, I'm sorry, Miss Jones, but you need to apply yourself more. Oh, to be in an English pub in spring, with frothing ales and tasty beers and all the joys it brings. Ooh, right now it's sadness and it's sorrow. Booba, booba, booba. but soon they'll open the doors. We'll be back in tomorrow. How about that?